Succession number 27083, Reel 3.
So, Henry, I'm sorry, we were going back to when you were 11 and back to Yana.
Yes. I think I mentioned earlier that my father was away a great deal at sea, and there were long spells and so forth. And when he got back home at the end of a commission, he was routinely regaled with a catalogue of, I have to say, mainly my misdemeanors during the period of his absence. And he had developed a sort of standard riposte to this, which he merely said, "Oh, well, it'll be all right when he's in the Navy." And although I wasn't present for this conversation, of course, but I treated my mother, and I may say I was devoted to both my parents. They were super. And I treated my mother in later years, and this is exactly what went on. And he said his usual thing, you know, "Oh, well, you're all right when he's in the Navy." And Mum rounded on him and said, "Well, that's what you always say. But have you ever discussed it with the boy?" And Dad wasn't very good at discussing things on which he'd already made his mind up and knew that he was right. "No," he said, I don't think it's necessary. "I really think you should." "Very well, I will." And the rest I can pick up from personal memory. He came up this dark winter's night, and I was in a room at the top of the house. And he came in, and we had no discussion. He said good night, and he switched out the light, left the room, shut the door, and then cracked the door open, stuck his head round, and speaking rather quickly, said, "I take it you've no objection to joining the Navy," slammed the door shut without waiting for an answer, went downstairs, turned to my mother and said, "I discussed it with the boy and it's all fixed." And 2 years later, I put on the King's uniform. And that was that. There was only one occasion, which I'll come to later on, when I regretted it, really. So,
if I may interject, you said you were devoted to your parents. Was this an unusual way for your father? Was this the normal way, I should say, for your father to behave with his children? It does seem, you were 11, it does seem unusual even for an 11-year-old.
No, I don't. He was being pretty abrupt because he didn't want to. He didn't want to have a discussion on the subject because he'd made his mind up I was going to go to the Navy. Had he asked me what I wanted to do, I would have said I wanted to drive a railway engine. And it took me 55 years to achieve that, but that's another matter. and so on. He was very good and very, you know, we used to go fishing together and all the rest of it. And he came, I suppose you'd say, right down to my level. And I was devoted to him. And that was easy, though I didn't always agree entirely, and so on. No, he was a very fine man. It was a tragedy when he was killed young. Well, I think I turn now to my last term at my prep school, and that was the spring term of 1937, and in the course of it I had to go through the mill for entry to Dartmouth. And the mill consisted really of three bits in no special order. There was a rather stiffer than some academic exam, part written, part oral, which took place in some ghastly place like Brussels Square, where there was a huge set of examination rooms and so forth. That was one part. Another part was the so-called Admiralty Interview Board, which took place in the Admiralty, and I'll come on to that in more detail in a second. And the third part, of course, was the medical, which was strict. The academic side was somewhere between common entrance and scholarship. I think it was generally agreed probably a bit closer to scholarship standard, but it wasn't at scholarship standard. In those days, most people went to Dartmouth at the age of 13, and Dartmouth was your public school. You could go to another public school and come in through what we all refer to as the side door, but that was rather unkind and quite unnecessary. And you joined up in the training cruiser to which you went on leaving Dartmouth, or had you been public school, whereas the darts did one term in the training cruiser, the pubs did two terms. The written exam, the academic exam, lasted 2 to 3 days, and it was tough going. I found it a great strain, I must say, but I got away with it, all right. And on the AIB side, the Admiralty Interview Board side, I can still remember, it was like a sort of passage from Boy's Own Paper. I was asked the most ridiculous questions. There were about five interviewers. There was an admiral, there was a headmaster, and there were other lesser mortals, and so forth. And I remember being asked where I was at school. Well, we only had to look at something. You had to write an essay on the most interesting holiday that you'd ever had, I think. And that gave them something on which to bite and probe the question. Not a bad idea. So I told them where I was at school. And then my questioner said, so how did you come to London? And I said, by train. And I was respectful, and I said, sir, to everybody, because it was the thing to do. They went on, unbelievable, really. And what was the colour of the engine? I had the remotest idea what the colour of the engine was. It was before the days of electric trains. So I said, dark green. Yes. And did you happen to notice the number of your ticket? And I began to sort of think, you know, this is getting a bit too glib, a bit too easy. A little sort of red light started to blink at me. And I said, no, I didn't, sir. I didn't think it mattered. And I got away with that. And then another one, I think probably the admiral, took me across to a map of the world on the wall and asked where my father was. And he was out on the China station at the time, driving Captain Cruiser. And the old Cumberland. And so I had to find my way by sea, of course, out to Hong Kong, Shanghai, and all that. And as we passed each place of note, he would say, and you were supposed to cough up Gibraltar or past Malta or the Suez Canal and all that sort of thing. It was quite a reasonable way of doing it. It was a geography lesson, right? And that was fine. And I was, I was doing all right. And then the schoolmaster leant forward. And he looked at me with a very, I thought, unkind, sort of serious face. He leant right forward and thrust his head out. He said, what's 19 times 21? And I was never particularly bright at mental arithmetic. And I knew that this was quite beyond me. So I picked a number. I knew it was up in the 300 or 400s, but not what. And so I trotted out some number. And he gave a sort of thin-lipped smile and said, "Oh, no. You see, it's 20 minus 1 and 20 plus 1, isn't it?" "Yes, sir," I said, giving a thin-lipped smile. And that was the end of my interview. And, of course, they were very hot in the medical on eyesight. Very hot indeed. And they presented you with quantities of cards which were full of little circles, almost spots, in different colours, and a lot of them were pastel, and you could just faintly pick out a number amongst this mass of stuff. This, I suppose, was to test whether you were colourblind or not. But I had no problem with that. So that was that, and I was in. And in those days, Gives, during your, well, at some stage during your exams, I forget if it was the academic or the amateur interview board, they had a representative there who took your measurements, even though they didn't know whether you passed your exam. They took your measurements and they built a suit. And that was it. So not all the suits were perhaps immaculately fitting, because they had to get rid of them somehow. And there it was. And I won't go further about that, because I think that's enough. And I come now to when I first joined Dartmouth. And that was in for the summer term, May 1937. We still lived at Yarna. And, of course, it was only, I suppose you were about 30 miles away from Dartmouth. And I remember my mother coming with me, and I joined, I think after tea in the evening. The new entry joined one day before the rest of the college came back from their leave, and so forth. And I remember my mother telling me that I might meet a cadet there called Dunbar Naismith. And did I remember that my godmother was a Dunbar Naismith? Well, I'd only met her once, I think. So it didn't really ring true. In fact, he was one of my first cadet captains. And we became great friends later, and so forth. And we, the form was that my entry was the first term of the house system, prior to which it had been the term system. And so you hear a lot of people older than me saying, I was a so-and-so, which was the name of their term, because they joined as an entry, and they went the whole way through the college as that entry, called such and such a term. In my case, you did your first two terms as an entry in a particular house, and you were then split up into one of five other houses, and you went up in that other house for the rest of your time, and you did one term short of 4 years. You did 11 terms. And I never heard a single word against this. You might have supposed that some of the old boys would have said, oh, they like it used, but I never heard any of that at all. And the advantage was, of course, that although you were mixing with invariably older people when you started off, as you moved up, it was both older and younger, and eventually they were all younger, and so on. And 6 months or so, even three, at that sort of age, means quite a lot. Well, my first term, there were 52 in my entry, 52 or 53. It was a big term. And the whole of my first term, I don't remember much detail about it. You were hungry, you were frightened, you were chastened. You slept in dormitories, containing, I suppose, a couple of dozen. Between two adjacent dormitories, end to end, were the loos and a huge lead-lined plunge and a few baths, not many, and some hand basins, which were metal, enameled, and they were set in sort of slate slots, great serried rows of these. And can we stop a moment?
I'm sorry, you said in your second term.
First term, I said hungry, frightened, chastened.
Your second term?
The second term, you made a few friends. You misbehaved when occasion offered, and you got beaten accordingly, and probably richly deserved. Your third term, of course, was different because you were then in your house for the future, because you've been split up into one of these five houses. And so all your, all the other inmates of that house were strangers to you, and you had to start pretty well from scratch again. That took you through your first year. And to be frank, at the end of that first year, the novelty of wearing a comical hat and brass buttons had largely worn off. And certainly in my case, and I think I was no exception, you were disappointed, you were frustrated, you were desperate to learn, because you were dead keen, and you were desperate to learn something about the Navy, and you didn't. Now that's a slight exaggeration, but what you learned was very little and was very poorly taught, which may seem surprising, but so much of it was old hat stuff. In the seamanship room, for example, where an officer, who was a lieutenant or a lieutenant commander, he would loll on a huge model of Nelson's forecastle, Nelson the battleship, forecastle, and he would read out from Seamanship Manual, Vol 1, vintage 1932. Which was a not the best ever written tome, frankly, and it was dead boring. And you got a fairly clear impression that he was reading that because he didn't know much about it either, really, and so forth. Then they'd have a length of wire, a jack stay, on which was a bit of rope. And you were taught some useful things. You were taught how to do a reef knot, which is very important. You were taught how to do a bowline. But the majority of the time, you were taught, because it was complex, how to do a thing called a man rope knot. And a man rope knot was, some might refer to it as a monkey's fist, at the end of a heaving line, or it was the end, if you had a bit of rope up a gangway, say, when you got to the end, you had the monkey's fist which stopped it running back, that sort of thing. Now, this was so old hat, it wasn't true. Then down in the workshops at Sankey, down on the river, you went from one shop to another. You learned how to file a brass block, which I never did very well because it was a bit lopsided or something. Nobody ever said to me why you were learning to file a brass block, but that was the requirement, and so you filed a brass block. You went to the, I forget, the blacksmith shop, and you were shown how the different colours rose when you were tempering a bit of steel. Not quite sure why you would wish to temper a bit of steel, and never again did I have an opportunity to do so. But, okay, that was it. In the pattern shop, you fiddle about with wood. And the pattern shop was run by a funny little man, I can't remember his name. And he was a practicing communist. Tiny little fella. And he had the habit, you know, we all got bored rigid with this lot, and so we'd say, you know, can I go to the heads, please, and so forth, just to escape. And as soon as your back was turned, he would turn to the next cadet and say, shake his head and say, sad case. He's a failure. He's always going to be a failure. And when your turn came to go to the heads, you knew perfectly well that he was saying exactly the same thing about you. It wasn't very convincing stuff. Another thing was, which did me no good at all, you had in your first term, you had to take a swimming test. Now, I was not a very good swimmer, and at my prep school, where we had an open-air bath with no mod cons at all, and I think it was declared open on something like the 1st of May, irrespective of. And I had some vague idea that you sort of waggled your arms about and did in order to do a dog paddle, but it was a pretty vague idea. Nobody ever really sort of taught me. And the gym instructor at my prep school, who was an ex-army PTI, I think, he had a long pole with a canvas loop on the end, and the loop was supposed to go under your armpits over your chest, and he would gradually relax the amount of lift until you were on your own and so forth. Well, he never did that to me. He held it a foot in front of my nose, and so you did a sort of scrabble dog paddle, and you were terrified. And you didn't get it right, and the water went up your nose, and then you drowned. And nobody ever taught me how to breathe while swimming, which is the essential thing about swimming, I think. And I still don't know how to breathe while swimming, which is why I'm no good at swimming. But anyway, the test at Dartmouth, you had to do... They dressed you in floppy overalls and a pair of gym shoes, and you had to do two lengths of the bath, and I was last by, a matter of minutes, I think, at the whole of my term, and I was knackered. And then they said, now, all you've got to do, that's easy, well done, sir, that's easy, now all you've got to do is to tread water. I'd never heard the expression before, so I trod, and of course nothing happened, and I sank. And the net result was I was given extra swimming instruction for the whole of the rest of that term, and I hated it.
Now, Sir Henry, I just want to interrupt here, if I may. You're the first person who has said, that I have interviewed, that the teaching at Dartmouth was poor. Mm. Edward Ashmore didn't mention that, Peter Hill Norton didn't mention that. Do you think that, looking back in retrospect, that you happened to hit... unfortunately, a bad set of instructors who happened to be at Dartmouth at that time, or do you think, in fact, that it was reflective of the general standard, unfortunately, that prevailed in the 30s?
Yeah, the latter. Very much the latter. I'll enlarge on this as I come on.
Yeah.
I started to... are we recording?
Yes, we are.
We are. I'm not sure whether you got this earlier on. The dormitories were placed end to end, and in between there were the wash places,
yes,
and the,
yes,
the plunge and the loos, and a few baths. And in order to have you were allowed 2 baths a week. But if you basically if you fagged for a cadet captain, you could earn an extra bath. I didn't care for the plunge, which is usually icy cold anyway. But I enjoyed my bath, and I was accustomed to having a bath every day in the evening. And I didn't say why the hell not. So I would do some fairly simple bit of fagging at the start of each term, gained my extra bath, and I then proceeded to bath every day for the rest of my time in college. And I never got rumbled on that. But this was, this inculcated an ability to deceive, which wasn't actually all that admirable, I don't think. Well, then, at the foot of your bed was your sea chest, which was an old-fashioned thing, and it was really in 2 halves, designed so that you could break it into 2 halves, and each half would then go down a hatchway. Pretty old stuff. And there was a set pattern for how you laid out your sea chest. Your shirt here, your underclothes there, your socks there. And you had a private toe, which had a lock on it, and you, and only you had the key, though I think anybody could have broken in quite easily. And say for God knows what you kept in there, because you didn't have any money anyway. And so on. And the routine in the morning for turning out was that at whatever they are was an old pensioner would he'd wake you up. They wasn't supposed to, probably about half an hour before go time, because you'd hear them filling the tin basins in the wash place with supposedly hot water. And so there was banging and crashing and so forth. And then 7:30 was, I think, the normal time for turning out. And about 7:25, they'd fling open the dormitory door leading to the wash places. And you'd see them there, they'd hover there, and at 7:30 the bell in the clock tower would strike, and the old pensioner would yell out, "Turn out!" And you turned out. And you quickly learned you had 7.5 minutes in which to leave your bed, strip off, go down, pretend to clean your teeth, probably didn't get much cleaning, and then you were in for the plunge. And sometimes your cadet captain supervised the plunge, and sometimes your term officer, house officer, did. But if they didn't, then it was essential to not clean your teeth, get out to the plunge, sprinkle water over your shoulders, make noises like "brrr, God, it's cold," and that sort of thing, and hope to get away with it. And then you went,
excuse me,